Some people look at the internet and see Big Brother, but Steve Johnson sees brotherhood, and a brotherhood that's creating artistic opportunities, disseminating vital information, and enabling political choice. As the title of his new book, Future Perfect, suggests, he's more than a little optimistic about the influence of networking in our lives. The book is published by Riverhead, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Stephen Johnson back to our show. It's a pleasure to see you again.
It's great to be here again.
I guess we shouldn't be surprised. Aren't you the guy who argued in an earlier book that television and video games are good for us?
Right.
I remember listeners getting upset.
This
by
is
that.
Easy compared to that. I mean, I feel like the case is a lot easier to make. The networks are helping us in video games.
But this is an extension of that thinking, isn't it?
Yeah, although I think it's making a slightly different argument, because it's not necessarily about the power of the internet and about technology. The internet is a great role model for the kind of success stories that I'm talking about in the book, but they're really about kind of ways of organizing people and of minds and of collaborating that sometimes involve technology but sometimes don't.
And I was surprised that you begin the book with the story of the so-called Miracle on the Hudson, with Captain Sully Sullenberger landing that plane and nobody getting hurt.
Yeah, well, I wanted to talk – I was talking at the very beginning of the book just about positive trends in society. We don't hear nearly enough about kind of slow, steady, incremental progress, because it's not newsworthy. So things that are getting better 1 or 2% a year just don't show up in the headlines, and yet that is where so much of progress comes from. And so I started with aviation safety, which has just been this amazing thing. It's so much – you're now more likely to be elected president of the United States in your lifetime than to die in a plane crash.
And the timing of that article was awkward, because you'd just written a story about safety in airplane travel. But I have to tell you, many years ago, before I got into radio, I worked in advertising, and one of my accounts was Frontier Airlines, which had never had – an accident. But they didn't want us to ever run an ad making that claim, because the next day they might have had an accident.
Right.
And they really did not want to invite that kind of discussion.
Yeah, it's true. And
so that's one of the reasons we don't talk about some of these.
Well, yeah, but I mean, there are many cases where I think we should be reminding people that there are, you know, kind of progressive developments happening all around us. But it's also not just that the trends are there in terms of aviation safety, but what is driving the trend. And in the case of, you know, Captain Sully, he performed brilliantly on that day, and it was an extraordinary story. But it was also the success of the plane and the engineering that went into the plane and the electronic system that helped him land the plane. And that was the work of thousands of people over, you know, decades, some of them working actually for NASA and the government, some of them in the private sector. And we don't tell those kinds of stories of group collaboration nearly as well as we tell stories of heroes.
Well, that's why you quibble about the use of the word miracle in that telling a story. But he did take over and manually land the plane.
He was assisted by the fly-by-wire electronics system of the plane, which was still on, and because there was still enough power because the engines hadn't totally failed. And so he was being partially kind of guided, and the kind of envelope of parameters that he could explore in landing the plane was limited by the fly-by-wire system.
And so what you were suggesting earlier is that when we cover stories, we kind of have a negative bias?
We have a bias either towards shiny new gadgets. That's the positive news. There's a new iPhone. We'll put it on the cover of Time. Or we have a bias towards stories of, you know, the plane crashes or the catastrophes, but stories of slow and steady progress. For instance, even with crime, where there has been some reporting on the amazing drop in crime in the United States, Gallup has done a series of polls over the last couple of years, and every year people say that crime is getting worse and worse and worse, when in fact one of the most amazing stories of the last 20 years is how much the crime has dropped.
But the press does report that. People that, are just that is, not listening.
Yeah, that is – well, it's partially that the people in general have a bias for negative news. And it distorts our sense of how well we're doing as a society if we don't hear about those things.
One of the other things you write about is France planned its railway system to be better than either that or Germany or England, both of which had developed their rail lines before France. So how did France plan to improve that?
They had a very centralized system. This is kind of one of the metaphors that I use in the book. So if you look at it from above, it forms this kind of star with all these kind of symmetrical lines coming together in at the center of Paris. And it turned out to be, while it was kind of beautiful and elegant, it turned out to be not nearly as efficient and resilient at kind of moving troops around or moving people around as these kind of less centralized networks that you found in Germany or in England. And so that's kind of a model for the way that states often plan things. They're very centralized. They can look nice, but they aren't as efficient and resilient and as innovative in solving new problems as these more decentralized approaches. And that's what the book is really about, is networks of collaboration that take that shape.
But to some degree, you're making the same argument President Obama made when he said you didn't build that. He got in a lot of trouble for that.
Well, actually, I'm glad you raised that, because what Obama said in that speech, the next line in that speech was, for instance, government built the internet so that then businesses could build on top of the internet. And actually, I have a quibble with that, which is to say that government funded the early research into the internet. But most of the internet, and then certainly the web and a lot of other technologies that we rely on, were not actually built by a government agency.
Well, it was built by the military.
It was funded by parts of the military, but almost all the people who were working on the internet were working actually in academic research labs or in think tanks. And the web was certainly not built by the military or the government. They were built by these decentralized networks of peers in more of an academic tradition. Nobody owned it. Nobody had any patents. Nobody tried to license it. And we're now completely dependent on that form of collaboration in what we do.
And the New York Times just wrote a series of articles in which they tell you that if you're calling your neighbor next door, the call which is dependent on all of those internet connections, goes to Greenland and then to Iceland and then to California and then Massachusetts, and it goes all around before it just reaches your neighbor right next door.
Yeah, and that
because that's an inefficient thing because of the way it was created.
Yeah, although ultimately it ends up being a better solution because it's more resilient if there are failure points. But the big point is that if you and I had been having this conversation 30 or 40 years ago and I said to you, we're going to start building things using these collaborative networks where nobody owns anything, where there's no private property, where there's kind of a collective open network, you would have said, hey, that's going to be really nice on your kind of Northern California commune, but it's never going to work in the real world. But the internet was built that way. The web was built that way.
Well, does this lead us to packet switching?
Well, packet switching is part of that, the idea that you kind of break up little pieces of information. You know, your email is kind of splintered into these small parts. So even the message itself is decentralized and distributed. But it's a kind of a philosophical approach to solving problems that we saw with the design of the internet.
You're talking to some degree also about decentralization here.
Yeah. And I'm talking about approaches to problem solving that don't necessarily involve technology. So think about local governments and the way that kind of communities solve problems in their neighborhoods. Or think about, you know, the incredible program 311 here in New York, which is really by letting anybody call three numbers on a phone and report a pothole or complain about a bar down the street or ask for a service. They've helped the city solve problems, identify needs of the citizens by creating this network of peers and neighbors who can contribute to that process even though they're not on the government payroll.
Now, you have a lot of different kinds of stories in this book, stories that don't suggest immediately that they fit into what we've been talking about. But, for example, you talk about Jerry and Monique Sternin going to Vietnam. Now, how does that apply to this discussion?
Yeah, well, because I'm talking about this, again, this approach, this peer network approach of solving problems. So the Sternins go to Vietnam to deal with childhood malnutrition. And instead of coming in as outside experts or bringing in a lot of food, they decide to look inside the community to see how the community itself is solving this problem of malnutrition. And they find what they call positive deviants, families where, for whatever reason, a child is actually getting enough food and weighing more than other children in other families. And then they figure out, what is that family doing? What is it about their diet that's different from their neighbors? And in the Sternin's case, they found that some of these families were feeding their kids these little crustaceans, little shrimp, that were otherwise seen as kind of low class. And so the other families weren't eating it. And they provided all this protein and vitamins. And so then they had the peers, the neighbors in the community who had adopted this strategy, share their diet, you know, kind of their strategies with their neighbors without the outside experts coming in and kind of telling people what to eat. And it turned out to be a much better way to improve the overall health of the community by allowing that internal knowledge to spread.
This was done without technology.
Exactly. The most advanced technology in the whole thing was the scale they were using to weigh the babies.
So we're talking about peer networks in this case, and you're suggesting that peer networks can work on that very much, that one-to-one level, but then when we extend it, we wind up back in the internet.
Yeah, and anytime
with things like, for example, the Kickstarter.
Kickstarter, right. Kickstarter, create a peer network of funders for creative work. Instead of having a big top-down organization like the NEA, from kind of supported by the government, you create this network of small funders. So you can solve problems. And what it sets up is a different kind of political worldview.
My guest is Stephen Johnson. His book, Future Perfect, The Case for Progress in a Networked Age. It is published by Riverhead Books. But Kickstarter provides services for different kinds of projects than the NEA. You're unlikely to see an avant-garde dance company getting much money from Kickstarter. You're more likely to see a rock group that wants to finance its new CD.
Yeah, although I talk in the book about this guy who wanted to create a 71-minute long music video for a very experimental kind of sampling a musician who kind of borrowed and repurposed other people's music. So it wasn't as if it was just a traditional, kind of rock video that they were trying to get funding for. There's a lot of variety there. But the big point is that it's an approach to the problem that isn't traditional market. It isn't traditional kind of, you know, corporate solutions to problems, and it's not traditional government solution to problems. It's that kind of new form of the peer network, which means that you have a slightly different kind of political set of beliefs if you believe in the power of these institutions.
In terms of traditional economics, isn't there something suspect about the lack of an upside to a Kickstarter donation? People don't get any money back if they've donated.
Well, they do get these kind of rewards, but they're not making an investment, right? So, you know, if you contribute $100 to the musician, they may come and, you know, serenade you with their guitar one night or whatever it is. They can set up
the money.
Right, exactly. But it's not a traditional investment. You're exactly right. And it's just like Wikipedia. I mean, there's, you know, think about how much labor has gone into building Wikipedia, all of it unpaid.
And you mentioned 311. Around 2005, the smell of maple syrup began to be detected occasionally in various places in New York City, and people were concerned, and they started calling 311. How does that connect to this?
Yeah, it's a great example of if you create a network of ordinary people who can contribute to the kind of overall knowledge of what's going on in the city, you can solve these novel, unexpected problems. So people were calling in because the city would smell like maple syrup on random days. Eventually, the city realized they were getting the kind of location of each of these calls each day that this would happen. And they looked at the weather data for each date, and they ended up creating this map that showed that the smells were coming from this very specific point in New Jersey where they were doing kind of artificial flavor and taste production, and they were making the flavor for cheap maple syrup knockoffs. So here you have this kind of strange mystery, and because anybody could kind of contribute to the solution by calling three numbers on a phone, they were able to come up with this answer.
We don't have a lot of time, but we've done a number of shows on how the internet is destroying traditional journalism, and it's not always a good thing. Although there have been positives, there have also been negatives. Do you see it as a mostly positive thing?
Think about this election we're having right now and think back to, what it was like to follow an election in, say, 1992. There is absolutely no contesting the fact that we have far more information now to help us make sense of what's going on with the election. We have wonderful reporting. We have wonderful commentary, sometimes from kind of academic bloggers who are part of the discussion now. We have amazing statistical analyses that didn't exist then, and we have direct access through the candidates through YouTube. I mean, there's just far more diverse voices out there covering this campaign.
And then we have blackouts in my area of internet service, so I can't gain access to that.
Well, we want to continue improving your service, for sure.
But you're suggesting that it's all wonderful. Most people aren't really even paying much attention to those blogs and the news that's available. I guess some people will look at Huffington Post or Politico, but they're likely to be news junkies who will also read the New York Times or the Washington Post every day.
Yeah, that's right. But the question is the news kind of ecosystem becoming richer and more diverse and more, you know, kind of engaged with what it's covering? And I think the answer is yes. Whether people are paying attention to it, well, were they paying attention to it in 1992?
Is it possible to apply peer progressive values to corporate structure?
One of the things we've seen actually in Silicon Valley is the success of those tech companies and part of the sector of the economy we all agree is doing very well. Those companies are far more decentralized in their decision making and far more egalitarian in the way that they share their profits with their employees. And I think that's a big part of the success of that tech sector is they actually aren't as top down and as, you know, kind of centralized as most East Coast companies were.
Stephen Johnson will be in conversation with Sherry Turkle next Wednesday, the 3rd, at 7 o'clock at the New York Public Library on 5th Avenue, 42nd Street. For more information about that and tickets, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. In fact, use the internet. His book is called Future Perfect, The Case for Progress in a Networked Age. It is published by Riverhead. And I want to thank you so much for coming back to our show today.
Always great to be here, Leonard.